She is a brilliant, very sick individual. She's an Italian American woman in New England, and in many ways, a traditional Italian American woman in New England. But she's also, I call it, she suffers from a spiritual autoimmune disease,
And what do
which
you mean by that?
so that manifests itself in her life as drug addiction, but also this sort of crippling self-hatred and attacking everyone around her that loves her and that she loves.
So, what was it like to be a child growing up in a house with her then?
Sometimes it was like the Willy Wonka factory. It was so much fun.
So, what were the fun parts?
Ice cream for breakfast, staying home from school just to watch movies. I never had to pretend to be sick to skip school. You know, that's those kids who fake a fever. I could just say, I don't want to go to school. And my mom said, fine. And we'd stay home and watch movies together. We'd skip school to go shopping together. We'd skip school to go to the museums together. I never had a bedtime. I did whatever I wanted whenever I wanted. And it was really fun. Other times it was really frightening. My mother had these highs and lows of moods, and when she was in a low mood, it could get really scary. It got really dark.
What were some of those times like, the lows?
Well, sometimes it was her in bed for several weeks on end, not getting out of bed, not opening the curtains, just this sitting in this room with a strata of smoke and her TV blinking in the corner, and my mother would, you know, a corpse basically. And then sometimes she was really rageful and she'd be, you know, opening the kitchen cabinets and finding whatever she could to throw at me and at my door. You know, it was anywhere from extreme violence to extreme catatonia. And in between, it was really fun. Yeah.
I'm watching you as you're answering and also listening to you. And I'm just kind of wondering, what's it like to, say my mom was in the kitchen looking for things to throw at me? I mean, it's your mom.
Right. Well, luckily she had horrible aim. And I also think that, you know, a mother's love does kick in. She didn't actually want to hit me with the cans she was throwing at me, but she just wanted to scare me. So she never, you know, she had terrible aim and she did love me. And so it was always the threat of violence, never actual violence, in our confrontations. But I never knew that life was different from that. You know, I accepted that my mother hung the sun in the sky and hung the moon at night, and as far as I was concerned. And I didn't know that there was a different way to live until much, much later. I was a late bloomer for that kind of realization. So I just accepted all of this as reality and within sort of an open mind and an open heart, and including the scary parts and the fun parts.
So you were talking about highs and lows. Some of the highs were quite literal because she was a drug user. Talk about that aspect of growing up with her.
Ever since I knew her, she was a cocaine addict. But that was the 80s. And so I thought everybody did cocaine in the 80s when I was a little kid. I thought that's what grown-ups did. And then sometime in the early 90s, she got into prescription painkillers, which like OxyContin, which, as you know, has took over America. Entire towns in Texas, Massachusetts, Missouri, everywhere. And then that led to street drugs like heroin.
And some of that filtered down to you.
Yeah, she shared. My mother shared everything with me. She shared Percocets with me when she had Percocets. She shared Valium with me when she had Valium. She shared OxyContins with me when she had OxyContins. It was part of her love, you know? It was like that's how she showed, that's how she took care of people. It was to help them get high. And I was no exception.
Was there anybody sort of in your sphere around you seeing this and going, this looks off to me?
I mean, eventually I got a boyfriend in college who scratched his head a little bit, but at the same time, I mean, it was just my mother was such this powerful force of nature that if you met her, if you were in a room with her, you didn't dare question her, you didn't dare fight her. And she also could be really loving and warm, and so you know, just to be in that embrace felt so good that, you know, you didn't want to get into a fight with her and question her.
One thing that's been so interesting to me reading the book and then reading reviews and responses, there's kind of a collection of words that people are using, tragic, heartbreaking, struggle growing up. But some of the stories in the book and some of what you're saying doesn't sound like that. It doesn't sound like if I said to you, so pick a word or two and describe your childhood, that you would necessarily use only negative words.
No, absolutely, I wouldn't. That would be, I mean, to color it in that one palette wouldn't show you the whole picture. It was more complicated than that. And that's what makes my life worth writing about in a memoir rather than just going to therapy and talking about it. Because it wasn't just tragic. It wasn't just traumatic. It was magical at times. You know, it was a dream come true sometimes. And it was a nightmare sometimes. And, you know, and that sometimes my mother was screaming and fighting with her boyfriend and would turn over a refrigerator with just the sheer force of her rage. And then sometimes she was finding a way to help me get into an exclusive boarding school so I can live out these dreams that she knew I should be having before I even knew to have them.
So if you could change anything then about that growing up time, would you?
No, nothing.
Not a thing?
No, I think it's a waste of time to have regrets. And who I am as a person is because of the life I've had. And I like who I am as a person. I like myself, and a lot of that has, a lot of the things I like about myself have come from my mother.
What are some of those things?
She was really just always from the beginning. We lived in this small town. It was very conservative, and she was always just sort of innately accepting before it was cool to be liberal or progressive or anything like that. So drag queens and drug addicts and homeless people and prostitutes, they were all just people to her. And she raised me to believe the same thing. And so now, as an adult, I extend that to everyone I meet and, you know, try to be the least judgmental as I can. And I love that about myself. So
you were geographically close to her really until college, mm-hmm. when you went to college in Ohio.
No, I went to boarding school
right.
when I was 15, but I was less than an hour away uh-huh. from her. So yeah, I was geographically close to her until college.
So what was it like that first time to really be away from her?
I missed the ocean more than I missed her. I remember that being the hardest thing when I was in Ohio, waking up and realizing that I couldn't drive to the ocean in 10 minutes. That was really scary. And by that point, I was happy not to be in the same state as my mother. I had started slowly to break away from her.
And what started that transition in your relationship with her?
I think the distance of being away in Ohio, being in college. I think also just the march of time and maturity. I was, you know, going from my teens into my 20s and starting to make choices about the woman I wanted to become and starting to see in that distance, starting to see my mother as someone who was sick, not someone who was this all powerful being whose moods determined my happiness.
There's so many parallel stories sort of going on at the same time. Now in high school, you started drinking.
Mm-hmm.
Take us through that thread of the story, because it started in high school and actually includes Austin
yes.
in that loop.
Yeah. I was a late bloomer. Where I come from, alcoholics start early, around 10 or 11, 12 years old. Those are the stories that I hear all the time. And I didn't really start drinking until I was 16 when I got my first boyfriend, because I could not deal with love at all. That was terrifying. And I remember I started drinking and thinking, oh, okay, this is how people get through life. This makes so much more sense now. Everything made sense once I started drinking. And I was a high-functioning alcoholic from the beginning, and that I got my homework done. And then later, when homework was no longer an issue, I got my work done, and I paid my taxes, and I paid my bills, and my apartment was clean, and I walked my dog. But I just, you know, I drank every single day. I drank until I blacked out. I drank alone. I drank in the mornings. And I thought that was fine because I wasn't hurting anybody. And then I moved to Austin, Texas, and I got a wonderful fellowship at the Michener Center for Writers as a grad student, which meant I didn't have to have a job. I had classes 3 times a week for about 3 hours, 3-hour classes, and the rest of the time was my time. So I had no restraints, and that's when my drinking really took off.
So you're in Austin, your drinking's taking off. You're even further away from your mother now. Mm-hmm. How is sort of all of that mixed together in a pot? What was that time like?
It was a huge part of me being able to break away from her, because she was now so far away from me, and her addictions had brought her to a point where she could no longer travel. By the time I moved to Texas, she was such a heroin addict and so sick that she couldn't have gotten onto a plane with the amount of chemicals and opiates that she needed to survive a weekend without herself getting really sick. So I, in a way, for the first time, I was safe. My mother couldn't come visit me. The only way she could see me is if I chose to visit her, and I had the power of that choice. And so that was sort of the beginning of a really important separation. Eventually, while I was living in Texas, I made the decision to cut her out of my life and then to change my number so she could no longer reach me. And I feel like that wouldn't have happened if I hadn't been in Texas.
Was there a moment or a thought or a person that kind of helped you turn that last corner and just say, I'm not going to make the call and I'm not going to answer the phone?
It was a long time coming. I'd had therapists for years say, you need to cut her out of your life. And I would stop seeing those therapists. I would say, okay, thank you. I'm not coming back. And then I would see therapists who would suggest it. And I would say, if you suggest that one more time, I won't be coming back. And so they learned not to say that anymore. Because I was so bound to her and I wanted to protect her. And I thought that somehow if I was still in her life, she'd be okay and I'd be okay. And, you know, it's the realization that anyone who loves an addict has to come to, which is you can't save this person. You can't. Your worry isn't going to save them. Your anxiety isn't going to save them. Your money isn't going to save them. She was getting worse and progressively worse. And she'd called me every day and she was getting really paranoid and started accusing me of having taped phone conversations with the DEA or the FBI. And I'd joke and I would be like, Mom, we're not that important. No one cares about us. But she was getting angrier and angrier and more paranoid until finally I snapped and there was so much in my life that I never told anybody about. And there was so much of her mothering and her life that I didn't tell anybody to protect her, you know, because I'd had therapists raise an eyebrow and say, you know, we can call the cops. And so I learned to shut my mouth. And so when she accused me of ratting her out to the DEA or the FBI or whatever organization was in her imagination that was following us, I'd lost it. That was the last straw. And I stopped talking to her.
And that was about 7 years ago?
Yes.
You speak about it. I mean, you're speaking very kind of straightforwardly and candidly about it. It must have been a hard thing to do, though.
It was the hardest thing I ever did in my life. It was really, really painful. And of course, it took me 6 months of listening to her messages every single day. And there were 12, 13 messages a day before I realized, oh, I could change my phone number and then I no longer have to hear these messages. But part of me was afraid. Part of me didn't think of that as an option. But I think a bigger part of me was afraid to let her go completely. And, you know, and I thought like, well, if I can just listen to her messages, at least I know she's still alive. And so that was the hardest thing, is to actually silence her by changing my phone number.
And how did cutting her off then change your life?
Well, it felt like there had been a death, you know, and I started speaking about her in the past tense, I think because I needed to, because I was so afraid that I'd lose the will to keep her out of my life. And she was a dangerous element. It was an important step for me getting her out of my life because I realized that the problems that I faced on a daily basis were not her making, they were mine. That my drinking was not, she wasn't pouring my drinks, I was. That the mess that I was making of my life was all my own doing, which meant that fixing my life was also my own responsibility. And it took me a couple of years of hard drinking, hard living, and not having contact with her to separate, you know, she didn't cause these problems. I'm doing this myself. And that was a wonderful realization because it gave me the power to take the next right action, which was to get sober.
I think somebody reading your book, though, might say, yes, you're responsible for your own actions, but she certainly laid a foundation in the way that you grew up, the way she raised you.
Right. I mean, yeah, but she laid a foundation for so many wonderful things too. You know, she instilled in me from a very young age that education was the key to everything. And she was right. And it was. And a solid education was my ticket to a new world. And she laid the foundation for that. She laid the foundation for when you have an emotion that you can't deal with, take a substance to make it go away, you know? But as I grew older, both of those things were in my power to control. I chose to go to grad school. That wasn't for anybody but for me. And I chose to drink. That wasn't for anybody but for me, you know? And so I can neither blame her nor accuse her for any of those things. Those were just, you know, these were the gifts she gave me and what I did with them was my choice.
And do you have desire to get back in touch with her? Is that something you see in your future?
I would love to. I'm working on that in the future.
You mentioned before a little bit about writing a memoir, and I'm curious, you know, you said, because of sort of the duality of growing up, mm-hmm. you know, you decided to write a memoir. And I think you said instead of just talking to a therapist about mm-hmm. what all was going on, if you could just talk a little bit about the process of bringing your story to a book and sharing it with lots and lots of people. I mean, the book is doing well. It's getting wonderful attention. What is it like to have your story kind of out there for everybody to see?
It's surreal, but it's also been really heartening. I've been getting messages from people from my past and just saying, I never knew I was going through all the same things. Thank you for telling our story. And that's been really powerful in the stuff that I didn't know. And that, you know, and to know that in telling the story, it's bigger than telling my story. It's telling other people's story. It's giving other people permission to feel and talk about things. It's opening up doors for people to have conversations with their mothers or their fathers that they've never had before. And so that has been an unintended gift. You know, I didn't expect that. I couldn't have predicted that, but it's been happening. So I've been getting little messages about things like that happening on day by day, and it's been really wonderful.
This might sound like kind of a corny question, but how would you describe your life right now?
It's blissfully boring. I love my life. I do a lot of yoga. I go to the dog park a lot. I drink a lot of coffee. You know, I set time aside every day to pray and meditate. I read books. I write. You know, I take naps. It's great. There's very little drama. And it's the life I've always wanted. It's the life I could never have imagined.
Domenica Ruda is the author of With or Without You, a memoir. And Domenica, we thank you so much for coming in today and talking about your memoir.
Thank you for having me.